This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Cloister. This is the author, James Carroll. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God. 1 John chapter 4, verse 7. Author's Note. Quotations from Abelard's The History of My Calamities and from the letters of Abelard and Eloise are from the classic 17th century rendition by the French Enlightenment figure Pierre Bayle, Letters of Abelard and Eloise, which appeared in an English translation by John Hughes in 1782. Other quotations are from The Lost Love Letters of Abelard and Eloise, edited and translated by Constant J. Muse, from Peter Abelard's Colaciones, edited and translated by John Marenbon and Giovanni Orlandi, and from a letter of Bernard of Clairvaux to Pope Innocent II, translated by Bruno Scott James. In these citations I have taken some minor editorial liberties for clarity and style. Biblical quotations are from the King James Version or, to reflect mid-20th century Catholic usage, the Douay-Rheims Bible. The anathemas from the 12th century Council of Sens are from Heinrich Denziger and Enchiridion Decrees of the Solemn Magisterium. Prologue. In the Duchy of Bourgogne in the year 1142, the largest church in Christendom stood on a hill above the tidy village of Cluny. That church, with its towering belfry, Corinthian columns, and massive rectangular pilasters, defined the pulse of the Benedictine Abbey of Cluny, a large walled complex itself the center of a vast monastic empire, counting 10,000 monks and nuns in foundations spread across the continent from the Mediterranean to the British Isles. The sharply pointed Cluny belfry was visible for miles around and had served across the last phase of a long journey as the locating focal point for the small band of horsemen that approached now, making its way up the final slope toward the monastery gate. The palfrey on which a heavily cloaked rider sat as it slowly ascended the hill was a lighter weight horse, and its unsteady gait suggested what a distance it had come. Trailing behind were four other ridden horses and a hitched pair pulling a covered cart. The wind was howling from the valley spread below, and the sun was low at the distant ridge. The stout wooden gate banged open. The porter rushed out, going to the first horse to take its headstall and stirrup. In a bustle of activity, others of the minor orders followed from within the monastic enclosure, the almoner, oblates, and lay brothers. A knot of black robes, they surrounded the riders and the cart. With the porter's help, the first rider dismounted, throwing aside the covering woolen mantle, and being seen only then for the religious woman she was. The porter bowed, showing his tonsure, muttering, "My lady." Two others in the party were religious sisters, clothed, like the first, in a long, gray, belted tunic, scapular, white coif, and veil, except that the fabric was the gray of rough, undyed wool. The garb was the habit of the Benedictine order. They were nuns. The party's six accompanying men were the horsemaster, the marshal, two armed henchmen, and two stewards. As the first nun, walking erect and at an authoritative clip, led the way through the gate, the receiving monks bowed, even while stealing glances at her sharply concentrated face. With whispers, they had spoken of this arrival, although this woman of slight stature and medium height did not match the measure of the songs sung in her name. She was the abbess Eloise, mother superior of the Abbey of the Paraclete, a ranking convent several days' journey by river and rough trail to the north. In those whispers, they had spoken of what she would be coming for. There would be further songs. The porter had been instructed to show her at once into the main cloister garden, to which women were ordinarily forbidden entrance, but the instruction had come from the abbot primate himself. At this time of year, the garden was still bare of fruit and berries, but twigs shone with the fresh scales of buds and shoots. The waters of the central fountain, drawing on the stream that ran below the monastic kitchens and toilet block, had quickened in recent weeks, but would not splash again until the coming spring rains replenished the flow. The normally bright marble of the arches and pillars of the surrounding arcade was dusky gray now, for the shadows of evening had settled on the place like loneliness. The Vespers bell would be ringing soon. The porter gestured at a garden bench, but did not wait to see if Mother Eloise would sit. She watched him hurry away, as relieved to be alone as, after the day's ride, she was to be standing. It was not long before the abbot primate entered, coming from the chapel. Because his collar was up, his face was shadowed. Across his chest was the leather strap of a pilgrim's satchel, hanging at his side. The unfettered stride with which he crossed to her suggested the depth of feeling she knew was there. His arms were stretched toward her, but as he drew close, she genuflected, a proper obeisance. With her head bowed, she reached for his hand, pulled it to her mouth, and kissed his ring. Grasping her upper arms, he lifted her. He lowered his cowl, unveiling sadness. "Where is he, Most Holy Father?" she asked. The abbot primate turned slightly, gesture enough to indicate the chapter house, the darkened room, close at hand, separated from the garden by a large arcaded gate of three stout arches, each one upheld by a clutch of fluted pillars. Mother Eloise peered into the room. Under the interlacing of groined ceiling vaults, the open space was large enough to accommodate the professed members of the monastic family, with each monk sitting at the wall on the stone bench that defined three sides of the rectangle. Now the room was vacant, but as her eyes adjusted, she made out the dark form of the catafalque standing in the center. She should have sought the abbot primate's sleeve to move away from him, but did not. Instead, she simply walked out of the garden, crossing through the arcade to enter the chapter house, going directly to the one for whom she'd come. Leaves of lavender and woodruff and dried rose petals were scattered on the floor. Pots of rose water stood at the four corners of the bier, but still the fetid odor of his decomposition came to her. He was clothed in his black habit, and his hands were hidden under the folds of his scapular. But the sight of his sharp-featured face, with its distinctive brow and aquiline nose, made her stop. Oh, Peter. Lifeless, yes, but also old. He had come into his seventh decade, yet she still thought of him as they had been before. The lids of his eyes were down, but his lips were slightly parted, the lips from which the most precious words had pierced her, the lips with which her own had been so sweetly caressed. His lips. She bent to them, touched them lightly with her cheek, then put her mouth on his. Oh, my Peter. The abbot primate took up a place behind her. To her back, he said quietly, "When I sent for you, I assumed he would still be alive at your arrival. I am sorry." He waited. When finally she turned to him, she said, "They condemned him because of me." Her voice was shot through with feeling, a mix of grief and anger. "Because I refused to renounce my love, because he remained mine through all calamity. I will publish his virtues across all the world to punish the age that has not valued him. It is true, mother. They hated him for what he had in you, but he opposed them in their vain repudiations of God's mercy. By the end, he was the exemplar of mercy. That is what he had from you. Mercy. Against all charges leveled at you, the measure of your love was mercy, not licentiousness. He disowned our promiscuity, I did not. He did what was necessary to keep his authority, as you yourself wanted. You flogged him with your writing to re-enter the fray, and he did. But look, her hand swept across the corpse. What authority has he now? They betrayed him, all of them. Not all. You, my lord, were his only friend. No, dear mother, many, many loved him. Where were they then, when the damnamus was pronounced, and pronounced again? Where was a hint of objecting murmur? You were not there, mother. But I was. The abbot looked at her aslant, as if to diagnose derangement. Impossible, a canonical council? No women were present. Enthroned beside King Louis? Does your monkish vow prevent even the perceiving of the female form? The queen, yes. The queen was there, pro forma. But otherwise, and the queen's party, the ladies in waiting, in the loggia, nearly out of sight. Ladies in waiting? With a half curtsy, the nun mocked herself. You? A consecrated woman among the courtiers? The abbot checked his first reaction and smiled. This Eloise was indomitable. Disguised as the widowed cousin of Her Majesty, she said. A consecrated woman dressed illicitly in the mourning clothes of a widow, but a widow is what she is. Eloise turned back toward the bier, perhaps in part to face away, as she said then, in the hour of his great test, I would not abandon him, unlike the others. It was as close to him as I could be. If the abbot primate is obliged to censure an undisciplined religious woman, so be it. Mother, what the abbot primate does not know, the abbot primate is under no obligation to censure. I know nothing of the queen's ladies. Queen Eleanor, as you do know, is a patroness of the Paraclete. Her Majesty is a devotee of the storied niece of Canon Fulbert. Your former notoriety defines her interest. Not former, the nun said, but quietly. The abbot primate continued, The queen cares only for romance, nothing for theology, and at the Council of Sens, theology was at issue. Romance and theology, father, only eunuchs would think they are unrelated. Mother Eloise raised her hand, a fist. Then she checked herself, biting her knuckles, letting her eyes fall again to the face of the dead man before her. Despite what they had done to him because of me, and despite his palsy, Peter Abelard was the only one in that large nave with manliness, the only one, I mean, besides you. She raised her eyes. Your bold statement rang like the word of Jehovah. I could not save him. All I could do as his canonical superior was confirm his appeal to the Roman pontiff and guarantee it. An appeal that was then promptly denied. The Pope excommunicated him, burned his books in front of St. Peter's Basilica, condemned all those who dare to follow in the way of Peter Abelard, anathema sit, the greatest man in Christendom. Yes, all of which I then myself appealed, with Peter's approval. The Pope is reassessing even now. I succeeded in getting Clairvaux to second my petition. Bernard, That false prophet, it was he who betrayed Peter. Yes, but he is remorseful. His support will help Pope Innocent overturn himself. The excommunication will be lifted. Now, more than ever, I will see to that. But again I ask, if so many others loved him, where were they when Clairvaux led that chorus of Damnamus? Afraid. They were afraid, Mother. The winds from Rome are fierce, and not only Rome. She knew this, of course. Peter Abelard, by the end, was tied by his enemies to the restlessness of the schools, but rowdy boy geniuses were the least of it. Abelard and the thinking he promoted were blamed for the rebelliousness of burghers. He was faulted even for the deceptions of the Jews. In those days, princes challenged bishops, but then yeomen challenged princes. Peasants obviously would be next. Order was shaken inside the church, but outside too. The king's sworn duty was to restore that order everywhere. Fierce winds, therefore, blew from his palace too. The savvy abbess understood. Alas, she had not understood soon enough. Yes, she had flogged him to re-enter the fray, entirely underestimating how lethal such an action might be. She said, Peter Abelard was an apostle of Caritas, yet he was damned. The excommunication will be lifted, the abbot said forcefully. I will make it happen. Then the gates of heaven will be opened to him. We will be authorized to inter him in sacred ground, and we will do that here at Cluny. No, I will have him at the Paraclete. I will have him with me. It's why I've come. Any ground that receives this man will be sacred. The abbot primate began to object, but she raised her hand again, stopping him. He stared at her. She did not blink. Finally, he lowered his eyes, one of the most powerful men in Christendom, yet he yielded to this woman. As for tonight, she said, I will not have this chapter house plunged into darkness. I want torches here until matins, and the paschal candle. The dynamic between abbot and abbess had reversed. Each saw it. Each assumed it. I want water brought in, she continued, heated water and cloths, incense, and scented oil. I will bathe him. The abbot primate bowed. She added more quietly, and perhaps a mat? Bundled straw will do. She would not be leaving him. Yes, the abbot said. I will depart with him tomorrow at first light. I will need fresh horses. He will be mine at last. After a long silence, the abbot pulled back the flap of his leather satchel and withdrew a sheaf of beribboned vellum sheets. He said, Peter asked me to return these to you. Mother Eloise received the bundle solemnly, knowing at once what it was. Her letters. All that she had written him. Once, Peter had said that it was womanly to say such letters, implying he never would. Yet he had. And then the abbot produced another pair of bundles. These also. His credo, a last explanation of himself. Solemnly he handed her the sheaf. And one other. He held the second, hesitating. An unfinished treatise, what he called Dialogue with the Jew. I alone have read it. Guard these words. Peter was never guarded with words. Eloise received the pages, but she was bristling. Guard these words, Mother. Clairvaux's dark angels are everywhere, spies, even here at Cluny. He joined with me in the petition to Rome only because he thinks he has heard the last from Peter Abelard. This treatise must not be published. They condemned him once because of the Jews. They will again. Jews are being attacked, murdered. If Peter wrote of Jews now, despite the council's damnamus, it was to defend our Lord's own cousins. For was Jesus Christ not a Jew? Mother, there are reports of Jews slaughtering Christian children to get their blood. That is nonsense. Perhaps. But Jews murdered their own children in Mainz. That is certain. To prevent their being kidnapped by the crossbearers and forcibly baptized, that was not murder, it was martyrdom. Be careful of that. These are fires from which we must protect Peter Abelard's name. Jews be damned. The battle now is for Peter's eternal salvation. We must have the anathema voided. Guard those words if you want the papal rescript granted. Father Abbott took hold of her forearm fiercely. For the sake of his eternal soul, Mother, guard those words. She clung to the pages. Despite the hot rush of what she felt, she nodded. A promise. The abbot held onto her arm for a moment more than was seemly. He said despite himself, "Your obstinacy is what Peter knew of you, but I see it too. Beware of your obstinacy, Mother." To his surprise, she leaned against him. "Inside, Holy Father, I am anything but obstinate. I am egg custard fallen." "The jongleurs sing otherwise." The abbot laughed, gave her one squeeze with his enclosing arm, and released her. "You, the infamous Eloise," he said, with a sudden rush of affection. "Their lyrics sing happily of your damning of the church, an abbess who damns the church. And you, the abbot primate, who receives her with a gentle hand." She straightened her spine, an unconscious gesture of will. She clutched the vellum pages close, deliberately pushing the bundle against her breast, to feel the pressure of the small ring of gold suspended on a chain hidden beneath her habit against her flesh. The abbot stepped back. But now with a bolt of feeling she reached for him. "Will you be at the gate in the morning, my lord? I will pray your blessing." "You will have it, mother. You will have it always. And now I must order your torches, the oils, and water." His authority was back. "I will send in bread and fruit, a cup, and the holy image of Our Lady." With that, the abbot primate turned and walked out into the cloister, the budding garden, over which darkness was soon to fall. Chapter 1. Father Michael Cavanaugh was at the communion rail, moving smoothly along, placing the wafer on the outstretched, glistening tongue of each of the ladies and the few gents who had come forward to drop to their knees. "Corpus Domini Nostri Jesu Christi," he intoned, but under his breath. Rubrics required him to recite the entire formula for each communicant, but no one did that. Aware of the swirl of his vestments, nicely in sync with the sidling altar boy, he kept the clip, speaking a phrase above each open mouth. "Custodiat animam tuam, in vitam aeternam." The trick was to keep from touching the knuckle of one's forefinger to the actual tongue, its saliva. "Amen." This was the six, the first mass each weekday morning. Counting the Monsignor, there were five priests on the staff of Good Shepherd Parish in Inwood, on the far tip of Manhattan, the only Catholic church on Broadway, even if it was a dozen miles north of the Broadway that counts. Cavanaugh, at 38, was senior to one of his fellow curates and could have drawn a later mass, but what the hell? His eyes routinely popped open at 5. Anyway, he found the jumble of the faith fully convincing only when it was dark outside. and here was Mrs. Heaney, in her black shawl and firmly shut eyes, an Irish divorcee, a woman whose husband had simply taken off, never to come back. She clutched rosary beads. Corpus Domini. Sergeant Kelly, uniformed and ready for the precinct follies, offered a trembler, the nervous tongue that, outside of church, habitually curled itself around the unlit stub of a cigar. One of Kelly's secrets was his Bell's palsy, a slight facial droop, which that cigar disguised while plugging the drool. Nostri Jesu. The priest knew Kelly's other secret, that, hitting the bottle, he hit his wife. Because Kavanaugh's priesthood was centered more on the confessional than the communion rail. He was regarded in the parish as kind, and a long line of penitents stood outside his booth every Saturday, which may have said more about his sternly judgmental brother priests than about him. In truth, sins whispered in the dark made Kavanaugh as sorry as the one whispering. He was not so much kind as aware of his own free-floating compunction, which made the priest's side of the confessional box his personal Holy of Holies. As for Kelly, the priest knew that the cop never took communion unless he'd kept his fists in check at home. Good man, Sergeant, Kavanaugh thought, but said only, Christy. And here was Benji Foley, the proprietor of the candy store across from the church, whose clientele was divided among schoolchildren, policy players, numbers runners, and whackers. Never one for the sacrament of penance, Foley knew that if he ever showed up on the other side of the sliding screen from Father Kavanaugh, he'd be forbidden to take communion, despite the priest's famous kindness, until the rackets went. Too many paychecks left at Foley's, too many legs broken by Foley's collectors, too much hidden juice. Kavanaugh knew that the bookie's throwing himself on his knees next to Sergeant Kelly was all part of the game. But it wasn't a priest's part to openly refuse communion. Custodiat animum tuum, even to this bastard. When Father Kavanaugh moved toward the next bent person along the rail, the sharp scent of Old Spice cologne hit him. The man was a lean, hunched-over figure with linked fingers clamped like a helmet to his head, which bent forward from the upended collar of a gray tweed overcoat. Because he was out of place in that company, Kavanaugh quickly took in his appearance. His trousers, emphatically displayed by his kneeling, were dark, sharply creased. He wore expensive-looking brown wingtips. His longish hair, in the interlocking thatch of his fingers, was a silvery blonde. There was something supplicant or defeated in the posture, which did not square with the well-cut downtown clothing. The priest broke stride, hesitated. The altar boy missed his step, tilting the golden plate he carried, the paten. Then the man lowered his hands, raised his head, and brought his sad black eyes up to Kavanaugh. His straight and steady gaze belied its bloodshot roominess. His necktie was loosened, and his collar was unbuttoned. There was exhaustion in the man, but also a kind of ferocity. Kavanaugh froze because, despite smart grooming rarely seen at Good Shepherd, and despite how the face had been touched by time, he knew it at once. Runner! The man met Kavanaugh's recognition with his own, but only for a moment. Without extending his tongue, he lowered his head again, bending forward, clasping his fingers atop his hair. The posture itself was an utter rejection of communion. Kavanaugh was stock still, confounded. This had never happened before. The man's refusal to open his mouth and take the host seemed personal, a refusal not of God, but of the priest. An indictment? There was nothing to do but move along the rail. The next communicant, another rosary-clutching, shawled grandmother, had left space between herself and the well-dressed man. Yet Kavanaugh came at her aslant, in order to keep the man in sight. By the time she had received and made the sign of the cross, the man was up and moving away. He was tall and still had the smooth stride of an athlete. Yes, runner. After Mass, in the sacristy, Kavanaugh removed the vestments quickly, assuming the man would be waiting in the shadowy rear of the church. But when the priest went out there, he was gone. Had this just been a dream? No. The air in the far vestibule, when Kavanaugh reached it, carried the lingering aroma of old spice, the rooting detail. He went out the heavy oaken doors. The damp November chill hit him square. In fact, that weather, vividly dank and gray, an endless threat of true winter, perfectly matched how Kavanaugh had come to feel about himself, a perpetual inner bleakness, yet always short of the true misery he'd have had to acknowledge. He could still deny the state he was in. He stood on the landing atop the wide staircase that ran down to the Broadway sidewalk. In the early morning fog, he glimpsed the lanky form heading south at a steady clip. The man made his way past the rarely shuttered Green Acres Bar, the A&P, Connor's funeral home. There were a couple of liquor stores on that block, but he passed them quickly. "Go, runner," the guys had called after John Malloy at track meets. His speed in foot races had given him his nickname. Runner could do the 100-yard dash in 11 seconds, the 220 in 23. Because of him, the much-disdained St. Joseph Seminary out of Yonkers, an unofficial entry, had unforgettably beaten Columbia and Fordham both in the 1935 Eastern States Interscholastics 15 years ago. John Malloy, assuming it was him, crossed 207th Street, moving purposefully. Why would he so pointedly show himself, then disappear? Kavanaugh, in his cassock, was not dressed for the street, but he followed anyway. He practically had to run to begin to close the distance. By the time he neared the corner, he had fallen in with the line of early shift workers making for the subway, and his billowing black robes drew glances as the people made way. Kavanaugh could just see him when Runner veered west at Dyckman Street, heading onto the overgrown pathway of the hilly bushland that separated Inwood from the Hudson River. To the working-class Irish of Good Shepherd, this end of Inwood Hill Park, running into Fort Tryon Park, was a forbidding place, forested and cleft by ravines and gulches, an old-growth nature preserve more than a playground. Younger boys made use of the near margins of the park to drift behind ill-kempt hedges for a smoke, and older ones, with girls, found nooks for making out, but otherwise all but the wildest kids avoided the place. There were caves, it was said, in which Indian bones and arrowheads could be found. More likely, the caves were the hollowed-out undersides of untended shrubs, ad hoc housing for the fearsome vagabonds who jungled in the park. But that was not Runner Malloy. Kavanaugh had lost sight of him. He stopped, checked his watch. He was the duty priest until mid-morning and had to get to the hospital to administer viaticum in the intensive care ward. "May the Lord Jesus Christ protect you," the words popped into his head, "and lead you to eternal life." A couple of hours later, dressed now in a plaid flannel shirt, sweater, and windbreaker, the priest tucked his breviary under his elbow, together with the small volume that was his current spiritual reading, and set out for the park again, not to find Runner Malloy, but simply to dispel the energy the phantom had ignited in him. That Kavanaugh had last glimpsed his old friend disappearing into the rough preserve lent the park a kind of mystical aura that morning, and it drew him. By the time Kavanaugh had finished the morning rounds at the hospital, he'd begun to wonder if he'd been mistaken at the early Mass. He hadn't seen Runner Malloy since the seminary, not long after that astounding track meet. But who presents himself at the communion rail and then rejects the sacred host? What the hell? Fort Tryon Park was nestled under the pinnacle and to the north of Washington Heights, the city's highest point. The only vista from which the park's own sharp elevation could actually be appreciated was across the river in New Jersey. Once a stroller left Broadway to enter the reserve, the air of an aboriginal landscape quickly imposed itself, and the place felt alien. Kavanaugh did not know what he was looking for. There might have been vagrants lurking in the hollowed-out shrubs, leftovers from the summer, when the park was said to be alive with hobos, down-and-out drifters, whose encampments the police would have ignored as long as they kept their distance from the museum that stood atop the hill. In fact, not so many tramps made their way this far uptown, a hard-scrabble district home to doormen and hacks, where panhandling wouldn't pay and free soup was scarce. As for the museum, it was an obscure outpost of the Met downtown, and the Irish of Inwood gave it a good leaving alone. At a parking lot inside a pair of tall stone pillars, it occurred to Kavanaugh that Runner might have left a car here. But at the far side of the park, at 190th Street, there was an out-of-the-way subway station, so perhaps he'd simply headed there, for the A train that would take him all the way to Lower Manhattan, where his fancy duds would fit in. Parking lot. Subway. That Kavanaugh did not know what the striding John Malloy had been gunning for underscored his perplexity. As he wandered the paths, he thought of those first days that had made them friends. They arrived at St. Joseph's Seminary in Yonkers on the same day in 1932, alike in being 20 years old, and in having a tremulous readiness to throw themselves off the cliff of God's grace, as the retreat master described what they were doing. With God's help, the priest said, they would find a way to fly. And did they ever? Dunwoody, as the place was called for the once pastoral corner of Yonkers it occupied, was the former country estate of a railroad baron. The already opulent mansion had been expanded, a license to crenellate in old country argot, into Patrick Cardinal Hayes's neo-Gothic fantasy of an Irish great house. Its demesne consisted of 100 acres of rolling lawn, which the Sulpician fathers had seen fit to turn into a golf course for the lads. It was easy to believe in miracles if, in the thick of the Depression, you went from being the unpromising second son of an unemployed Hell's Kitchen longshoreman, or, in Runner's case, of a long laid-off Poughkeepsie millworker, to being a connoisseur of golf clubs, knowing the difference between a brassy, a spoon, and a mashie niblick. On long, easy strolls between tea and green, Runner and Kavanaugh had become chums. That Runner had later dropped out of the seminary and of Kavanaugh's life had left Kavanaugh in a lurch from which, apparently, given the sense of dislocation just triggered by the man's abrupt reappearance, Kavanaugh had yet to extricate himself fully. He wandered the park for most of an hour, and was in the thickly wooded well of a glen when it began to rain. He wasn't sure which way was out. The path ahead ascended steeply, and he took it, cursing himself for not having worn a hat. At first, the rain was light, but it began to come down sharply, and he picked up the pace, moving steadily uphill. Because the path was serpentine, the foliage overgrown, and the downpour heavy, he could not see ahead. And it surprised him when, as he was taking a last turn, the huge museum building appeared above, looming like a granite butte. He headed for it. An American Catholic should have loved that place. The museum took the form of a medieval monastery, with elements plucked from the rubble of a long-lost Europe and lovingly restored on a pinnacle overlooking the Hudson River. But at that point, few Catholics did. The cloisters housed the Metropolitan Art Museum's masterpiece collection of tapestries, altarpieces, frescoes, sculpted figures, fountains, and stained glass windows, all dating to between the 12th and 15th centuries. But the cloisters was not a true monastery, or even an authentic imitation. It was a Rockefeller-funded fantasy structure, a mishmash of belfries, architectural fragments, aged pillars, arched doorways, stairways, arcades, all tastefully reassembled to evoke the high romance of Gothic revival that had so quickened the patrician imagination of the Gilded Age. The inspiration here was not Saint Henry, the patron hallow of the childless and the handicapped, but Henry Adams, for whom Chartres triumph was only aesthetic. In fact, the museum was a stunning monument to the artistic achievement of Catholic high culture, but Kavanaugh's parishioners knew better than to consider it theirs. What were a bunch of moth-eaten old wall hangings or limestone statues with smashed faces anyway? What counted in monasteries were the monks and nuns and their spiritual works of mercy, men and women on their knees, not gawking at pictures. To the good people of Good Shepherd, the cloisters seemed a peculiar, haunted emptiness, and, but for the handful of Irish who found employment there as guards or maintenance men, the parish was content to ignore it. Kavanaugh rushed into the place for its shelter from the rain. Inside the entrance, a prim woman sat at a desk. She looked up, startled. There was a box for a voluntary contribution. "Cats and dogs out there," Kavanaugh said. He threw some change into the box, picked up a brochure, and turned to enter, shaking water off his shoulders. His books were tucked under his jacket. He'd be a prod tourist for an hour, what the hell. He'd been in there once, years before, but had forgotten that the first sensation was of claustrophobia. The entranceway was a long, low, windowless corridor, sloping upward, evoking the dark tunnel of a mythic initiation. The corridor led to a set of rough stone stairs that spiraled up to the next level, to a great stone octagonal antechamber, higher than it was wide, that served as the museum's true entrance hall. From clear-story windows above, the dull November light washed down on the several artworks that decorated the walls. Artworks here, but once they had been consecrated altarpieces. Kavanaugh recognized, because of the pictured staff and animal skin cloak, a primitive portrait of John the Baptist, together with a rendering, the lion, of St. Mark. Another woman sat at a desk in a corner, focused on pages under a gooseneck lamp. Several doorways led multidirectionally out of the hall, and Kavanaugh chose one at random, having to stoop slightly as he passed through. He was startled to hear the atonal chanting of monks just audible, as if coming from a nearby closed-in chapel. But it was newfangled piped-in music. Fake. A short walk down a stone corridor, hung with a gruesome crucifix, a penitent Magdalene, and a sorrowful Madonna, led into a large rectangular enclosure organized around a glassed-in courtyard, a classic rendition of the ancient monastic hub. The quadrangle was defined by a long, four-sided arcade that begged to be walked around. Originally, the space would have been open to the air, a garden for growing herbs and fruit centered on a fountain. The limestone fountain was there, but dry, and the few potted plants suggested that most others had been taken to some greenhouse for the winter. Above, on the paneled glass canopy, the rain danced, but soundlessly. At the far opposite side of the colonnade, a small group of people were gathered around a painting, too far away to notice or care about the complications of a momentarily thrown, middle-aged priest. to his right through a semicircular arch, whose Romanesque sturdiness jarred with the more delicately pointed Gothic-era arches of the arcade proper, was a vacant, unfurnished, low-ceilinged hall with a stone bench running along all three walls. He went in, as if the room had been his destination all along, and he took up a place on the bench, as if he had a right to be there. Alone, he unzipped his jacket and put his books on the bench beside him. He resolved to block out the canned Gregorian chant, but then realized the ersatz music was sparing him the problem of a deadly silence. In holy silence, so the prophets say, men like him are supposed to hear the voice of God. But Kavanaugh never heard a thing. He picked up his breviary again and reflexively flipped the ribbon to the appointed page. He began to read the day's psalms, as if he were a monk. Cloister, he heard some moments later, from the Latin, claustrum, for closed. A voice had finally come to Kavanaugh, but it was some woman's. He did not look up. In French, she continued, we say cloître. In this museum, we have five distinct cloisters, hence the plural of the museum's name, the cloisters. But this one, dating to the 12th century, is the jewel, the one around which all the others are organized, the reason we are here. When Kavanaugh raised his eyes, it was to find that instead of along the arcade or at the closed-in quad, the woman was looking directly at him. She was a museum docent, clearly. She was giving instruction to a clutch of ladies whose look was fixed the other way down the aisle of the colonnade along which the docent had been pointing. She had spoken enough so that Kavanaugh took in her French accent. There was an aphonic quality to her voice, low-pitched, rough, suggesting a whisper, even though she could readily be heard. When their eyes met, they held each other's gaze for a long moment. Then she faced away and resumed. When this cloister was in its monastery, La Chapelle-sur-Loire, in southern Bourgogne, its dimensions were twice this size. The ladies earnestly looked about the quadrangle, taking in its pink marble arches and supporting columns, capitals elaborated with carved pine cones, acanthus leaves, and animal heads. A gray pallor hung over the scene because the glass roof above showed the weather. The ladies, in from Scarsdale or someplace, wore tailored suits of coral, mauve, pale green, but even those colors seemed subdued by the downwash of murky air. They wore flat-crowned hats and sensible shoes, with handbags at their elbows. Constructed most of 1,000 years ago, the docent took several steps away from the group, letting her long, thin arm carve a graceful arc, encompassing the entire scene in unfeigned gesture of delight. This was the enclosure onto which all of the monastic buildings would have opened, the chapel, refectory, dormitories, kitchen, and chapter house. At this last phrase, she threw a sidelong glance Kavanaugh's way, which made him realize that chapter house referred to the room he'd settled in. She resumed, "The cloister provided the monks or nuns with isolation from the world outside. In this courtyard, the monks or nuns grew vegetables, prayed, read, took meditative walks, and washed themselves. Here, in this very place, picture them, all in silence, magnum silentium." As if in emphasis, she stopped speaking, quieting even her gaze, which lifted to settle on the roofline of the arcade. Through the glass could be seen ochre tiles with lips curving over the limestone entablature, resting on the ranks of columns and arches. It seemed wrong, suddenly, that the rain was blocked from falling into the courtyard. The docent turned, taking a few steps along the arcade. The ladies followed. "This cloister," she continued, carefully pronouncing each word but with that Gallic intonation, formed the center of one of the network of Benedictine foundations attached to the great abbey at Cluny. She described Cluny's place on the plain between the Loire and the Rhone, strategic river openings to the Atlantic and the Mediterranean both. Cluny, she said, was a fulcrum of culture, or, as we say in French, le point d'appui. Her spiel was practiced, but did not seem canned. She simply knew what she was talking about. She had fallen into an unself-conscious pose, letting her fingers rest in a stone crevice, joining a pillar to its sculpted capital, her hand at a level just above her head. She was tall. She was dressed unremarkably in black laced Oxford shoes, a long dark skirt, and a white blouse whose pointed collars were slightly askew above a formless, fully buttoned cardigan sweater. She wore no jewelry. The slender hand at her hollow cheek emphasized an overall litheness. Her black hair was cut short like a man's, close against her skull. Her clothing hung on her loosely. She was not lithe, he saw now, but extremely thin, as if her body had known malnourishment, a wasting disease in her past, perhaps, consumption, tuberculosis. The only skin showing was at her hands and face, but it carried the hint of an ashen hue. "If you please," the woman said, moving the group along. "This carving of a double-headed monster," they began to drift away toward a new threshold, "which invites the viewer to contemplate as the monks and nuns always would have." Her last words carried back to Kavanaugh. "The great struggle between vice and virtue." Then they were gone. His reading of the breviary amounted to going through the motions. He put the woman out of his mind, but then had to fend off memories of Dunwoodie again. In fact, the museum's piped-in syllabic chant fueled the distraction, since Runner had chaired the Schola, the small seminary choir that led the way each day through the communal incantations of Matins, Vespers, and Compline. Here, the recorded music with antiphons and responsories was on a 10-minute loop that circled from the Kyrie to the Spiritus Domini to the Laetatis Sum and back again, but under it all, Kavanaugh kept hearing Runner muscle through the high notes of Panis Angelicus. "I beg your pardon, sir." Kavanaugh looked up, surprised to find the docent standing before him at the threshold of the so-called chapter house. She was hugging herself against the chill, which made her seem even more slender, as delicate as one of the thin pillars in the arcade behind her. Her fingers were long, bony. The expression on her face was neutral, but Kavanaugh felt rebuked nonetheless, as if he'd stayed past closing time. He lifted his book, letting its ribbons drape, and attempted a smile. "No actual prayers allowed?" She smiled, but thinly, ignoring the little jibe. "I simply wanted you to know there will be another general museum tour in 15 minutes, if it pleases you." He sensed that her job depended on having people actually show up in this remote outpost and then bother to follow her around. Kavanaugh was relieved to have his brooding interrupted. When he looked at his watch, though, she took it as refusal and half turned away. He stood. "I'm Father Kavanaugh from Good Shepherd, the church up Broadway a few blocks." He stepped toward her and offered his hand. He smiled. "Out of uniform." "Hello, Father." She took his hand. Her grip was firm, but her fingers, yes, were very bony. Still, something soft was showing itself. Something vulnerable. "I am Rachel Vedette," she said. "You're French." "Yes." "That's a coincidence." He turned back to the bench to pick up his other book. "I've been reading a French woman's book." He displayed it. The docent glanced at the volume. "Simone Veil," she said. but with a sort of wince. Her expression surprised him. Vey was much written about that year. Her book was something of a sensation, even among New York intellectuals. "Why do you cringe?" She shook her head. "No, really," the priest said. Her slight but visceral recoiling could not have been more surprising. But she deflected him. "Perhaps you could say what you admire about her." He gestured with the book. "It's called Waiting for God." "Yes, letters," she exchanged with the priest. "That's right, but that's not why I'm reading it." "Why then?" "Because waiting for God implies she doesn't have him. Nothing pious here. She is with the misfits and the outsiders." "She is with the anti-Semites."
"What?"
"Simon Vey was an anti-Semite." "An anti-Semite," he answered. "I thought she was a Jew." "She was born a Jew, but her embrace of the church fueled her contempt for her native Judaism, the worst kind of anti-Semite." Her hand went to her mouth as if to shut it. "But I am sorry," she said. "It is rude of me to speak so bluntly."
"Embrace of the church? She could never accept baptism. She writes harshly about it."
Kavanaugh was thrown that the docent had indeed spoken so directly. Her accent lent authority to her surprising statement. Still, lifting the book, he ventured, "She says she would never join an institution that regards itself as identical with Christ." The woman checked herself. "You are correct, Father. I spoke wrongly. Her embrace was of Jesus more than the church, although, as I recall, she spoke of her love for him as remaining, how do we say this, unconsummated." She lowered her eyes, suddenly shy, as if the word's implications embarrassed her. Kavanaugh suddenly saw the docent's gaunt appearance as a version of the French mystics. They had been famously malnourished, indeed. She died from a self-imposed hunger strike, an ultimate identification with victims of the war. To Kavanaugh, Vey had seemed a kind of martyr, and he'd found her book, with its rejection of conventional religiosity, an astonishment. But now he saw that this woman before him, even in deriding Vey, was like her. Not only gaunt, but brusquely candid, she said what she thought. "Unlike me," Kavanaugh said to himself. He was a maestro of indirection. For example, this unexpected exchange had made apparent that the docent herself was Jewish. Yet the priest could not ask the question that prompted, "What is a Jew doing here, in this artificial homage to Christendom, giving tours on medieval monasticism?" Instead, trying to demonstrate some further appreciation of the French writer, he said, "Perhaps it is for her seriousness in the face of what happened in Europe that Simone Weil is valued."
"Is it serious," Rachel Vedette said with fresh severity, "to analogize the ancient Hebrews with the Nazis?"
"Does she do that?"
"Yes, despite having been forced out of her teaching post because of Vichy laws against Jews. Ancient Israel to her was the beast, although you may not know this because I doubt that her cahier, notebooks, have been published in English. It's true, I don't read French. This is the only book I know."
"That one is a good book, I agree. It displays her empathy with suffering, which was limited but quite real."
"And her longing for transcendence," Kavanaugh dared to say.
"Yes, that too."
"And as for the complications of her being Jewish," Miss Vedette shrugged. "You are right. Complications of being Jewish." She smiled. "Why not?" That she had no interest in judging him or in puncturing his pretensions made it possible for him to ask his question, although still obliquely.
"So your expertise is Catholicism?
French history, in point of fact. Le Moyen Âge. The church, of course, is necessary for that."
"Of course. Although
Unlike Simon Vey, she said, I do not know priests.
Kavanaugh bowed slightly.